Tēnā koutou katoa. Nau mai, haere mai, ki te Indigenous Urbanism, Aotearoa Edition, Episode 20. I'm your host, Jay Kake, and this is Indigenous Urbanism, stories about the spaces we inhabit and the community drivers and practitioners who are shaping those environments and decolonizing through design. On this episode of Indigenous Urbanism, we speak with Dr. Patrick Stewart, a citizen of the Nisga'a Nation in northwestern BC, from the community of Gingogs and a member of the Killer Whale House of Daxan. His Nisga'a name is Lagigu, which means calm waters. Patrick is the founding principal of Patrick R. Stewart Architect, an architectural firm with a First Nations community development focus, which has been operating in Stolor Territory in Chilliwack, BC since 1995. Kia ora, Patrick. Thank you for sitting down with me. So my first question is, who are you, where are you from, and what do you do?
My name is Patrick Stewart. My Nisga'a name is Lagigu. I'm an architect from Canada. I'm from northwestern British Columbia.
I met you actually 2 years ago,
right,
when you came over with a group of other Canadian and you know, First Nations Indigenous architects. And that was really exciting because that was definitely a first for me. And since then, we've came to visit you last year. Mm-hmm. And that was really wonderful. You showed us around some of your projects and we spent time together also in Ottawa with the symposium.
Yes.
And now here we are again. And some really cool stuff that's come out of that. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of the collaboration that's emerged in this dialogue between Indigenous architects.
Well, it has started in the last maybe 3 years, 4 years, where us as practitioners have started to find others. I mean, it's sort of an organic thing in a sense. It's like, hey, you know, you see some project designed by somebody and you think, well, I should talk to them. And it just sort of grows like that. You find out names of people. And I've had a 10-year-long collaboration with Australia, so I've known those guys. And Rui Thompson had been collaborating there as well, and he was the first Maori architect I met. We were at conferences together. We were on a speaking tour together in Australia. And so, yeah, it was good. And Kevin O'Brien and Dylan Comanberry, the two of them were our sort of anchor points there. Michael Mossman has come on since over there. And that country being closer to here than I am, they knew more people. So they knew Ro and they knew. So that's how that sort of happened. And then finding out about Nahaho and thought, well, that's really good. We don't have an organization like Nahaho in a sense. I chair the Indigenous Task Force for RAIC, but that's, you know, that's the National Architectural Organization. But they do, or did, see their way to having something Indigenous. And that's been a good rallying point for all of us. But we're not our own organization. And, you know, just leaving Tammy's presentation on the AICAE, I'm a member of that. And I was in Albuquerque last year when they had their meeting. And Michael Lavador, who's the president, we were talking about, we need to do something. So, you know, we were talking about, and I've got to talk to the RAIC about that, if we can have some kind of link between organizations. It would be good if we had something with Nahaho as well.
Building our networks, we're getting strength in numbers.
We are. And when I was in 2011, in Australia, we formed a loose organization, and it actually had funding. I don't know if the funding's still there, but it was called the Indigenous Network of International Network of Indigenous Architects. That was just something we put up, and the University of Sydney funded it, and we had some money, and we did a few things through that. But everybody has a busy life, and everybody goes back to their own country, and it's like, time flies.
Especially for Indigenous architects, they're often wearing a million hats and doing many projects and network building, and you feel like you have to carry the weight of a movement on your shoulders. But I think when you come somewhere like this, you kind of realize actually we are all really busy, but it's important to be able to come together and support one another.
It's true. We are busy, and we're always, I think, very positive despite the context we all work in. But we have to be positive because we have to look to the future. And I think that's one aspect that we all have, because we're all looking to change how the countries we live in accept our cultures.
And having that very long-range vision. I mean, we're always thinking very far back, but also very far forward.
Right. But far forward is out there, but we still have to get through tomorrow. So
it's attention.
It is.
I heard you mention recently that a group of architects from Turtle Island are sending a delegation over to Venice and developing a pavilion for the Biennale. Could you talk a little bit more about how that came about?
Our Indigenous Task Force has been working on projects, or our mandate is to assist First Nations communities in their built environment, whatever that means, whatever First Nation needs, and they will pose problems. And we've been doing that, and I think that's how the symposium came about, because it's like everybody's bursting with ideas, and we just thought, we have enough knowledge here, we can share it. So hence our symposium. We invited a contingent from over here, and you guys came, and that was great. I mean, people are still raving about the symposium, and one want to know when the next one is going to be.
It was life-changing for us, that's for sure.
It was great. It was very good. And I think that's why we have such a good response of people coming here again, right? So this is the next sort of event. But after the symposium was done, we just looked at each other and thought, what do we do now?
What next? We're ready.
Yeah. So Canada Council issued a call for proposals for representing Canada in the 2018 Architecture Biennale in Venice. So we thought, well, what the heck? We don't expect to win, but let's put in a proposal. And we put in a proposal, and heck, we won. So...
oh, hell, now we have to do it.
Now we have to do it. That's a big problem. When we put in the proposal, there was a couple of us, three of us, I think, that were really putting the ideas in. And I thought, well, we should honor Douglas, because Douglas Cardinal is our elder architect in the country. He's going to be 84 this year. And I thought, well, we should hold him up as our leader. We thought it was a great idea, but it's turned out to be a bit of a responsibility, because all of a sudden the government says, okay, you're the leader, you got to sign the contract and you got to be responsible fiscally.
No, it's become the burden on him.
Oh, yeah. So we didn't realize that, but we've all told Douglas that we didn't want this to be a burden on him. So anything we can do, then let us know and we'll do it. And we just pitch in and do that. But it has been a challenge. I mean, we haven't done this before. It's the first Indigenous entry into the Architecture Biennale from Canada.
Because normally you come in under the colonial governments. I know that we have had involvement, Ro and Rewi had been involved in previous New Zealand pavilions.
Yes.
But again, it wasn't an entirely Indigenous group or entirely Indigenous concept.
Right. Well, we've been at this now to say that, you know, it's not good enough to do it for us anymore, you know. So we thought, well, we'll do it. We'll put an all-Indigenous team in, and we did. And then compromises and complexities set in, and it turns out to be what it is, and it's a big challenge. Canada's a big country, and we have people raised scattered across the country, and that always increases the cost. We have a film team that has to travel across the country to film everybody and their work and all that stuff, and that's expensive.
So how many architects involved, and what's the concept?
We have about 18 members on our team. And the idea is to showcase each architect's work. So I think we call ourselves Exhibiting Architects as part of the team, though that's our title. But we have formed research teams. We have four research teams. And we just divided us all up into those teams. We put a woman architect as the head of each team. That was important to honor the women on the team, so they've been charged with bringing us together, and we've had teleconferences trying to figure out within that area what we want to present, how we want to present that. The idea is that each territory that we're researching will be presented. Each architect, registered architect, will be presented, and then their work will be presented. We want to talk about the history of Canada and colonization, and that's one of the territories, and what that's done. And territories of indigeneity, we'll talk about how we're trying to get out from under that colonizing regime and be our own.
So it sounds like a really challenging project, but when you pull it off, which you will, what is that going to mean for Indigenous peoples in Canada and for the architecture profession?
Well, already the architecture profession has had to sit up and notice. It's like that we had won the right to represent Canada. Never happened before, nobody expected it, but here we are. So one thing we found, and this is sort of fallen back to on our Indigenous task force, that people are finding out about it, and they're phoning us. We'll get ministers, government ministers, both provincial and federal, phoning us and saying, we want to find out more about the Indigenous task force. How can you help us? Which is kind of bizarre.
We're just traveling. They know you're here.
So it's kind of bizarre because we're not sure of their sincerity, or because it's a bureaucracy, government. And what impact are we going to be able to do, right? They have ideas like creating a National Indigenous Centre in Ottawa by giving us a former embassy right across the street from Parliament Hill. And that happened last summer, and I came out against it in the media, and that was a bit of a challenge. And so now they're trying to get around me by going to other people and saying, isn't this still a good idea? We want to give you this building. And we said, well, it's a historic building, for one thing. It was the former American embassy. And, some of us are feeling like you're just giving us your old handoffs, because the building's been vacant for 20 years. And they built a brand new American embassy, and those guys moved out and went somewhere else. And so it sat empty. And they tried to turn it into other buildings, and nobody really wanted it. So they said, well, let's give it to the Indians, and it'll
be... Surely they'll be grateful.
Yeah, of course. So, I said, well, we didn't want it, but if we had to take that site because that was all the game was, I said, let's demolish it and start again. And I got in heck for that. Even the RAAC got after me, saying, it's a heritage building, you can't demolish it. And it's like, well...
Whose heritage?
Yeah, really, that's what we said.
And sometimes it's a funny tension when there's this real insistence on preserving heritage architecture that sometimes actually has a lot of pain associated with it for Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And it's also something that nobody really loves or wants anymore. But because we're bound by kind of legislation to celebrate anything that has that kind of colonial heritage, you're not allowed to do anything with it.
Well, Canadian government has it's more than a program, but it's some kind of mandate they have on reconciliation. Mm. So, which to me is just a bogus concept. It's like, we don't have anything to reconcile. We didn't do anything. We're the victims. It was our land that was stolen. We didn't steal any settlers' lands or anything like that. They came over here. We didn't ask them to come. But it's all the settlers that are trying to reconcile, and they're pushing it on us and making it our responsibility, saying, how would you handle reconciliation of such and such a topic? And it's like, I wouldn't. But it's an issue. But then they tie dollars to it. If you want dollars, then you have to submit a proposal, and it has to include an element of reconciliation.
And it's like, really?
They do. And it's a complex thing. It makes it difficult. And so that's why I say nothing is ever as it seems, right? A gift is a Trojan horse. It's like, wow. Once you unpack that, there's so many issues they have to deal with. And if you start accepting those gifts, what does that make you, or what does that say, right? So we have to see what happens. But
challenging landscape that you're navigating.
Totally.
So another thing I did want to talk a bit about is your work back at home. So I understand you live a little way out of Vancouver, but your traditional territories are quite far from there. And you spoke a little bit about it yesterday, I guess the challenges of being somewhere very remote. So something I'm really interested in is that tension between working in remote Hokianga home communities versus being in an urban environment where a lot of our Indigenous people now live, and also the experience of being a visitor in another nation and the way you kind of work with the home peoples there.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you could maybe reflect a little on your practice in relation to your tribal affiliations and identity, and then working and being like out of place.
I'll always acknowledge who I am and my culture. So it is, the lens through which I work, and that carries with me. Doesn't matter what community I live in or work in, sorry. And it is a calling card in a sense. It opens doors because people understand where I'm from. And so from one First Nations to another, there's some commonalities. And it depends on which community you're going to or which nation you're going to. They want to know who your grandparents are, who your parents are, and, all that stuff. And that's been valuable. Your question about remote versus urban, we have a growing issue in Canada where more and more people are moving to urban areas, and it probably isn't isolated to Canada. Australia and New Zealand probably have similar issues where people are leaving their home communities and reasons of lack of housing, lack of education, lack of medical services, lots of reasons, lack of work. So people go where the work is or where the housing is, where the school opportunities are, or people will move for the kids for school. Like, for example, in my community, there's no high school. So kids have to leave. Where do they go? Right? Since our treaty in 2000, there's been a road put through to our community, but the high school's a drive. It's 2 hours. So the kids have to get on the bus like at 7 in the morning to get to school by 9, and then they get home at supper time. That's a long day for kids.
It's a lot of time in transit.
It is, yeah. So it's either that or they move.
You go to boarding school or the whole family moves.
Sometimes the whole family moves, and sometimes they won't stay up north because they'll think, like a lot of people think, go to a big city where there's more opportunity.
And often this becomes intergenerational. So one generation might go there thinking it's temporary for opportunity, but two generations, their family might still be in the city and maybe they don't return to their home community or they start to experience that disconnection.
Well, that's true. Once somebody leaves a home community, like my mother left our community and never went back. And we've never moved there. So she's not alone. All her siblings moved, so there's none of my uncles or aunts are there because there's just no opportunities. But having left, now there's no housing, right? So you can't go back. You can't go back. So it's just a compounding issue.
Acknowledging that architecture is just one part of some of the solutions to these complex social and economic issues, notwithstanding, how do you as an architect respond to working in that context?
Well, different ways, I suppose. Some communities will ask me to come in to fill a specific need. So I've done some elders housing for a couple communities. So that's a specific housing type. But I've been getting involved lately with some more experimental housing, both of a modular type and an alternative construction type that is sort of low-tech, very basic, off-the-grid kind of thinking. But it's exciting.
Accessible to those communities.
Yeah. So they're using resources in a different way. I don't know if you know cordwood construction. Mm. So because BC has such forest resources, there's a lot of waste. And
from the timber industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So in one community, well, one area of the province in the southeast, when they chop the trees down and take it out, they will clear the land, but they just pile it up. They just make big mountains of all this timber waste because it's not the right grade or whatever, but it's got cut down, and they just leave it to rot. Or they'll burn it, but burning is a big issue in the province ecologically and because we have big forest fire problems. So what this one community is thinking is to go and access that timber that's left, the cuts, and use that in cordwood. And it's handmade, hand-built housing, and it's low-tech, but people have been living in those kinds of houses for hundreds of years.
But we're really seeing the potential of going back to some of these self-build models, but utilizing aspects of technology to allow that to happen.
Yeah, trying to fit the modern with historical building types.
I think we need to be having those conversations too and considering those options, because something we have the same problems here where a lot of our families, particularly in rural areas, are on very low incomes. They haven't got the kind of mindset around having a thing like a mortgage, and probably it would be irresponsible to be given one given the low employment and low economic opportunities in that area. And we've got a lot of whānau who they don't have rent because they live on their own land, but they live in very poor substandard housing.
Right.
And I think for those families, we need to be thinking, well, how can they be supported to respond to their own housing need?
Right. And one idea, I suppose, is to have the homeowner, participate in the construction. Mm. It's low tech, but if they want a house, then they have to put in the effort. Their family has to put in the effort. And there's another community in BC that has done that, and they've got good results. And they've taken the whole community off the grid. It's all solar powered.
Wow. Is it a microgrid or individual dwellings?
Individual dwellings, but they make money. They sell back to the grid, and every homeowner participates. So that seems to be a, another option.
For self-sufficiency, but also some economic development.
Yes. Well, and the non-Indigenous community that surrounds them, the city, the Capital Commission, has started to take notice that here's a community that's off the grid and they're making money by selling power back to the grid. And so they're employing the community. Mm. And other companies have tried to hire their workers away because they see the success and the community's hanging on to them. And they're now selling services to the non-Indigenous communities and providing them with solar power. It's great. And, you know,
innovation in action.
Yeah. No, it's good.
Indigenous communities leading the way. That's what we like to hear.
And we have other technologies, like wind power is another one. Some communities are really embracing wind and powering their communities. So that's a thing on the coast of British Columbia where we have the winds always constant. I'm sure you got winds constant here too. But they're starting to look at wind, and I know our nation has developed a wind power company, I guess, and exploring, you know, how they can build these wind farms, provide energy and economic development for people.
Something I really loved when we came to visit you and you took us to Seabird Island.
Yes.
And we visited the community center there, and there was this kind of incredible slash awful juxtaposition between your building and this very famous work of architecture next door, and just hearing that actually this much photographed, many awards building, the community didn't really love it.
No.
And they had lots of problems with it.
They did, and that was right from the get-go. And again, it's a government origination, I guess, in terms of they had a budget to build a school and they thought, wouldn't it be cool if we gave the community a nice looking school? And that's what they did. They said, we've got a school to you, here it is. And the school got built and the community wasn't consulted. That was their first mistake. They had no input into it. So when I came around to do the community center, they took me through the school and said, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. And it's just like, holy cow, a whole long list of things that I shouldn't do because they're not going to like it if I put them in their building, in the new building. And so I quite often say that our building's in a sense in reaction to that, but I see that as a totally colonist kind of construction because the community had no input.
Well, the process was all wrong, and I think so much of Indigenous architecture is about process.
Right.
And you can create a really beautiful-looking object, and yes, it is a beautiful-looking object, but if you don't actually work with the community, they're never going to... it's not going to be what they wanted,
no.
And they're not going to have ownership of it.
Well, they're not going to have a good positive sense about the building. Mm-hmm. So they have vandalism. They don't maintain the building well. It's 20-some-odd years old now, and it doesn't look so nice anymore. And I don't know what their intent is, but it's looking tired. So I look at our building where we had total community involvement. We used traditional form. It was a community-built project. So all the timber was sourced from their land. They milled it. They kiln-dried it. They built it with their own teams. They stained it, you know. They applied their own artwork or their own cultural symbols to the building. And the building's well taken care of. You know, they maintain it and they love it. So to me, that is a successful building because I can go back and, you know, it's 20-some-odd years old and it still looks very good.
Now, something I really enjoyed when we went there, I can't remember what color it was originally, but you said, oh, no, it was originally this color and they've painted it a different color. But what I really liked is that you were very relaxed about it. You're like, oh, well, it's their building. Whatever they like is fine.
Well...
Instead of being very precious, which I think architects sometimes can be, that's not what I designed.
When it comes to color, so this is just something that I've always done because I see color as a transitory thing. It isn't permanent, so it can be changed at any time. So one thing I don't do, and this is just my own particular whatever, I don't usually pick the colors. Because to me, again, this is a very visual object in their community. If they want it to be green or red, then they should be able to have it green or red. And if I want it brown, I shouldn't be allowed to have it brown. So if they change the color, that's okay. Form's still there, building's still there, it still operates the way it's supposed to. They're still happy with it. They're probably happier with it now that they change the color. But it still has a fresh face, and to me that shows that they're maintaining it, as opposed to if they left it that same color 20 years later, it might look tired. I mean, yes, they could have painted it the same color, but they decided not. And it's like, that's okay, I don't have a problem with it. Yeah. I don't know if you remember Corbusier's project in France in Pessac, where he built these workers' houses back in the 20s, I think. And his idea was that he built the box, the frame, and yes, it was a complete house, but he then allowed the inhabitants to change it. And they did over 20 years or 30 years, well, still exists today. They've added on, they've changed the windows, they've just done all kinds of things. And it's because that's the way they live, and that makes them, you know, create the environment that they want. So I don't really see that as an issue.
Well, I've got one last question. The title of the podcast is Indigenous Urbanism, and we're looking at how Indigenous communities in the current political environment and increasing capacity and capability, how Indigenous communities are increasingly able to shape and influence their physical environments. So I just wanted to know if you had any concluding thoughts on that.
Well, it's a good question. And as more and more architects who are Indigenous are getting into practice and working in urban areas, it's becoming a point of discussion. Different people handle it differently. Yesterday, when we did the keynotes, our opening speaker, Tamari, I went up to him after and I just thanked him for his words, because he said, now's the time to end the subtlety. He says, we need to have it in their face, or visual representation.
Smash
right?
Him with it.
Exactly. And that has been my modus operandi since I started, because to me, our culture was ended violently. Our visual representation of our culture ended violently. Our houses were burnt or smashed down on the North Coast. Our totem poles were cut down, floated away to museums. All our regalia, our musical instruments, our clothing were all bundled up and taken away. And they didn't burn them or throw them away necessarily, because they thought, hey, this rattle could be valuable, and people put it in their private collections. And there are people in BC that have collections worth millions of dollars that are now the heirs from the old missionaries, right? So because of that violence, I think it's only appropriate that we put it back in a way violently by building it. So that we put it, you know, I put totem poles in the city in front of my buildings, and I use traditional form, and I put it in the city, and I use the colors, the traditional colors, and I put it in the city, and the city hall responds like saying, that's exotic, we can't have that. And it's like, we come back at them and say, is Chinatown exotic? Because you allow that. And they say, well, no, but that's just like an enclave kind of thing. And it's just like, okay, well, we're not an enclave, but we're building in the city, and we want to do this. As an architect, one of the things City Hall expects is that, A, you're a registered architect, you've sworn the oath, you know the laws and the rules and the regulations, and you're duty-bound to respect them. So City Hall says, when we say no, we mean no. So I just turn to my client and I say, they won't let us do this certain aspect of the building, and you need to go talk to the city. Because City Hall is afraid of owners. They pay the taxes. They build the things. They're the ones that are sort of creating the built environment from an ownership perspective. And my clients will go and talk to City Hall, and they get their way. So I don't have to be the bad guy, and I don't have to butt my head against the city.
You have to fight them.
No, because it's a losing battle for me. But for the owner to go, it's a win for him, a win for me, and on we go.
Kind of a really important thing about resisting that blending with the colonial landscape, because I think only if you put things forward that are quite bold and reassert Indigenous identity will that landscape start to change. I don't think you can really start from a gradual position, because it's so far away currently.
Well, to me, subtlety is just people miss it. It's just like, you know, and there are Indigenous architects who are very subtle, and they don't believe using things like traditional form colors is the way to go. They want to be modern, and they want to be subtle. And it's like, okay, be subtle, but nobody's going to understand what the heck it is. But that's okay. That's their perspective. And to me, that's not a strong position. That's watered down. To me, if we're serving the culture, then we have to privilege that culture, and we have to represent that culture.
Unapologetically,
in the way that the culture wants to be represented. I don't do this just out of my brain and say, one day I'm going to just draw this and build it. It's like, no, I have a client who's of the culture, and they say, this is what we want, and this is what we agree to. And when this is, you know...
And you have that responsibility to facilitate that and bring it to life.
Yes. Mm.
interpreting things and putting them into the built environment.
Right. Hmm. And to me, that's a successful partnership between a community and what we do. And that's one thing I've always said is I do facilitate design. Thanks for bringing that up. Because, you know, the building is their legacy. It's not mine. I will help them get it built, but then I'm gone.
And they have to live with that building.
They have to live with it. You just took the words right out of my mouth.
You can find out more about Patrick's work at patrickstewartarchitect.com. This episode was recorded on location at Ngā Te Kore, the second International Indigenous Designers Hui, hosted by Ngā Ahu in March 2018. Indigenous Urbanism is a production of Te Matapihi. Sandy Wakefield does our sound recording, editing and mixing. Our theme was composed by Thomas Burton. I'm Jay Kake, your host and executive producer. For more information about today's show and other episodes of Indigenous Urbanism, go to indigenousurbanism.net. You can drop us a line at info@indigenousurbanism.net. And if you like what you're hearing, please give us a review or rating on iTunes. Coming up next on Indigenous Urbanism, we travel to Ōtautahi Christchurch to see how Ngāi Tahu and Ngāi Tuahuriri are working with the city, designers and developers to reveal and rebuild a world-leading, authentic, post-colonial city of the future.
At the core of everything that we do is the environment, is the natural resources. And if we're looking after those natural resources, then everything else will fall into place, you know, and we would have rivers we can swim in, rivers that are full of kai and much healthier, you know, we would be much healthier as humans and much closer as whānau, because we'd be doing more things with the environment and for the environment. So I think that's where we need to be heading. That must surely be the future.